In all of our talk this season about new ways of doing things, about abandoning the stuff of our past and applying new technologies and new ways of thinking to the solving of new problems, what we've mostly not talked about is another country that actually is doing things differently, at least differently from us.
Hi, I'm Kai-Fu Lee, Chairman and CEO of Sinovation Ventures, and I recently wrote the book, AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order.
Before we round out the second season of Anatomy of Next, I thought it would be interesting to talk about China. Kai-Fu Lee is Chairman and CEO of Sinovation Ventures. He's also the author of the recent book, AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. We talked about, as you might have guessed from the title of his book, artificial intelligence, technology in China, and what all of this means for us and the world.
I originally wanted to write a book about AI because I've been working on AI for the last 37 years, since my sophomore year in college, and I've worked on AI at Apple, Microsoft, Google, and of course now as an investor in Sinovation Ventures. I see tremendous opportunities based on the recent advances on applying narrow intelligence to all kinds of problems. I think it is the biggest technical revolution. It's similar to electricity, but also it will bring up a lot of issues such as security, privacy, and most importantly, job displacements. And that's the purpose of the book. And then my publisher said, in order to publish your book, you are also the expert on China. Please bring a China angle in. So I did.
And what is that angle?
Well, the angle is that China has caught up with the U.S. in AI implementation and monetization. Therefore, a dual engine will make AI revolution go even faster.
Before we get too much deeper into the discussion, I think it's worth pausing really quickly and just defining AI. You know, everyone sort of uses artificial intelligence in a different way. What do you mean when you're talking about artificial intelligence?
I'm talking about a set of algorithms that are now being used in real-world applications. So deep learning, reinforcement learning, GAN, and technologies like that. Basically, artificial narrow intelligence. So in one single domain, use a lot of data to train a system to make decisions, predictions, classifications, and so on.
And what are some real-world examples of that? Maybe companies that or products that people use often that employ these types of things?
Well, all internet companies use it. Amazon, Google, Facebook use it to target ads, sort newsfeed, and also banks use it for credit card fraud. Insurance companies will use it more and more. And beyond that, also speech recognition, face recognition, computer vision, and robots and autonomous vehicles. So all of these are applications of the same type of machine learning technologies.
Now, you have, I would say, the somewhat controversial take on the state of China's technological proficiency versus the U.S.'s, the United States's technological ability. You know, you're saying that we're sort of at the same level. Would you first agree that that's a controversial take in the U.S.? And second, maybe just like dig a little more into that with me. How is that? How did that happen?
Sure.
How is that true?
Sure. Well, once I clarify, everybody agrees with me because it's not declaring China in an overall technical parity or victory over the U.S. First, the academic research is by far stronger in the U.S. The main point I'm making is first, the most of what's already been invented for AI, plus their natural commercial extensions, will fuel a big technical revolution already. That's not to say there couldn't be another big breakthrough. And should another big breakthrough come about, that could give advantage to the country and company or university that comes up with a breakthrough. However, the second point I make is a big breakthrough isn't very likely, isn't as likely as some people say, because in the last 62 years of AI, there has been only one real breakthrough, and that was deep learning about 9 years ago. So to predict there would be many others in the next 5 or 10 years would seem aggressive to me. And then the third point I make is that given a lot of these technologies are relatively in the open space, in many cases with open source that one could take off GitHub and then refine and build, and also tools like TensorFlow and the Chinese equivalent are getting good enough for good engineers who don't know a lot about AI to tweak it. So the Chinese tweak things a lot faster, and also China has a lot more data. And actually, China has more AI investment, plus the Chinese government's very supportive. So that has caused, just in the last 2.5 years, China to go from almost very little AI to a country that has the world's most valuable speech recognition, machine translation, computer vision, and drone company in the whole world.
Would it be fair to characterize, I think it was the second point, as China is very good at scaling and the US is very good at innovating?
Yeah, that's fair.
So now on the innovation side, you said a moment ago that you didn't see how it seemed aggressive to predict further innovations in the space. I agree that it's impossible to predict innovations. But with AI, is it somewhat the nature of the beast here that with innovation in the field come future innovations?
Well,
wouldn't deep learning help us?
Yeah, well, there will be small innovations, reinforcement learning, GAN are examples of extensions of deep learning that make it work better. And those are mastered by the Chinese entrepreneurs and the American entrepreneurs. So they're both moving forward on that. But let's explore a little bit. Let's say there is a huge breakthrough tomorrow, and who gains? Well, I would argue if it's in academia, anywhere in the world, they're probably rushing to publish it on the internet, on the archive. And once it's published, people will figure it out. And it's unlikely to be patent protected, or maybe not even protectable, depending on what kind of breakthrough it is. So that wouldn't give an advantage to a company or a country. But if it were invented inside Alphabet Google, which is also very possible, then it's all up to Google on what they would do with the technology. Do they publish it? Do they keep it as a trade secret? Do they put it into TensorFlow, thereby allowing other people to use it without disclosing the details? But undoubtedly, in that case, it would give Google and perhaps also US an advantage. So I'm just projecting that a big breakthrough seems unlikely. Even if it's made, if it's an academia space, it's fairly open, doesn't give anyone advantage. So only when it's made in a walled garden or a corporate like Google or Facebook, then that would give the company some advantage. So it's less likely.
What do you think is keeping the US back in terms of rapidly scaling? Why is China so much faster at us?
There are two fundamental reasons. Well, one, as I mentioned, is the large amount of data. China has more people and there are more usage scenarios and data per user. If you look at my phone, I'm a bicultural user. I'm in WeChat 50-60% of the time. And that giant app sucks so much data that gives them basically rocket fuel to build AI. So more data is one point. More usages, people in China order takeouts 10 times as more often as in the US. People use mobile payment 50 times more often than the US. All that becomes data that goes to the AI companies rather than the financial institutions like credit cards or banks. But the other reason is that the Chinese entrepreneurs are more hungry, tenacious, and work harder. And again, that could be controversial. People could argue, is that sustainable? Is that good for their health? But without discussing those issues, I think the fact is that the Chinese entrepreneurial style is quite in contrast of Silicon Valley style.
How would you characterize Silicon Valley style?
Silicon Valley style is very visionary, prefers to be low capital expenditure, very technical driven, and about changing the world. And I think the Chinese model is build a business that makes money, win, become number one, and also do whatever it takes to win, including really heavy, ugly work. To give an example, in the US, there's Yelp, right? Groupon, two very good companies that are very light in spirit. In China, the equivalent company is called Meituan. They basically went after a very audacious goal of changing the way Chinese people eat. And in order to do that, they needed to deliver food to anybody within 30 minutes at 70 cents per delivery order. Most Americans wouldn't deal with that or would say, well, let's wait until drones can do that. Then it'll be very cheap. But the Chinese companies went out and tried to figure out a way to do it. Eventually, they built an Uber model and found 600,000 people who make basically near minimum wage with various incentives who are on the system delivering on electrical mopeds, which is the only vehicle cheap enough to deliver, and then deal with all the issues like high turnover of the 600,000 people. And this is managed by a startup, and also deal with the battery powers that run out because it's a cheap moped. But in the end, they achieved the 70 cents per order. And once they've done that, they build a very big moat for competitors to enter the space, and therefore achieving winner in this winner-take-all gladiatorial competition. But for our conversation also accumulates the data of how Chinese people eat. So Meituan knows more about that than probably anyone else in China.
Now, that doesn't necessarily sound like something that would seem foreign in the Silicon Valley context to me. That sounds like a handful of different startups I can think of. But one thing that you mentioned that is really resonating with me is the idea of hard work being essential.
Yeah.
I don't know how deeply this idea that you don't have to work hard has permeated the entire culture here, but certainly there's a fad among technology journalists to push this narrative, and among some entrepreneurs to kind of peacock with it and virtue signal with it online, to talk about, you know, the importance of work-life balance and taking lots of time off, and slowly but surely modeling themselves more after our European style, sort of, we work to live, not live to work. I don't know how many people really believe it, but let's just talk about hard work for a minute.
Okay.
How many hours a day should people be working? How many hours a week should people be working? Is it healthy to work sort of nonstop around the clock? Is there maybe a way to just work more smartly? People always say we work less time but smarter.
Yes.
What would you say to this?
Well, I'm very, very conflicted on this issue because on the one hand, in my own personal experience, I have been a workaholic and I paid very dearly for it, sacrificing my family's work lifetime with them, and also getting cancer. And then the doctors just told me to stop. So I, in some sense, am the role model of showing people, hey, you can't do this. But at the same time, I have to tell you, as much as I try, the entrepreneurs I fund in China, they are just unstoppable. Well, let me first tell you about their work ethic and then tell you what I tried to do and then what happened. So I think their work hours are probably between 70 and 90 hours per week, and generally characterized by 996 or 997. That is 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week or 7 days a week. And these are the unspoken work hours, and the leader starts from the top, work this hard, and so everybody feels like they need to follow. Another aspect of Chinese entrepreneurs and startups is that the single leader is by far the largest shareholder, usually not a team of two or three complementary equals, but one person makes all the calls and then others follow him or her. And then that person sets the tone, company's direction, vision, specific decisions, turn on the dime, make quick decisions. Those are critical also to pivoting startups and AI and data collection and the like, but also sets himself or herself as a model for all the others to follow. So that is the culture. It's a single person at the top working 70, 90 hours a week. And basically that is what it takes to go to a startup. If you don't want to do that, you could work for a large company, which also works very hard. Tencent, I've seen pictures of Tencent, that one of the perhaps second largest company in the internet in China. At 2 a.m., there were queues of taxi ready to take people home at 2 a.m. So people are working incredibly hard. So is this detrimental to their health? Well, and is this really not working smart? I would argue that I'm very concerned about their health because I've been through the same, and the stress, lack of sleep, all those things, drinking so much coffee and not having a life, I think is not why we're humans on Earth. I very much want them to change. But I think the other issue about not working smart. This is not mutually exclusive. I think if you are truly hungry, imagine you're a Chinese entrepreneur or engineer, you've been poor for 20 generations, you're the only child in the family, your two parents and four grandparents have only you to look to bring them out of poverty. You have that much pressure and expectation to work incredibly hard, and you feel it's your duty to your family to do that, and therefore you're hungry, you're ambitious, this is your life's dream, you put everything in, you're working hard, but you're arguably also working smart because this is motivationally driven. It's not like some abusive boss is trying to squeeze the last minute out of you, but it's you willingly doing it. So that's the difference. And what I have tried as the VC is, you know, we would set up activities, family activities, weekend activities, exercises. We go for walks. We have bicycle tournaments. And what I find is that top 25% of our invested companies never come. Not a single employee comes. The ones that are not doing so well, they tend to come more.
The work hard versus smart thing and your response to it struck a chord with me. Online, I was watching this sort of debate blossom a while ago. There's an investor, his name's Keith Raboy, and he gets into a lot of trouble on Twitter for basically saying, you have to work hard. To succeed, you have to work hard, and a lot. And he's, I think, somewhat of a workaholic himself, but even that word has a sort of weird venom to it, workaholic. And to me, it's just like, you love your work. You're working all the time, or it could be that. And certainly it's that with Keith. And he said something, I don't have it verbatim, but his point was like, people were saying, you know, you don't have to work hard, you just have to work a lot smarter. And Keith was like, you're not smarter than me, so you're going to have to work as hard as me as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's true. Like, these people who are working hard are not less intelligent than you. They're not going to go after those time hacks as well. They're going to take those time hacks and do other things on top of them.
That's right.
So you have to just be able to compete with them on every dimension.
Well, it's got to be work smart times work hard, mm-hmm. assuming, you know, you're not burned out, assuming you're motivated.
Now, broader question. Why is all of this important? Specifically, why is it important to be thinking about China's potential dominance in the field of artificial intelligence? What does that mean for the West?
Well, first, I think there are models that could be consulted and mutually learned from each other. You mentioned earlier that you thought my example of Meituan may not be so unique that there are companies in the U.S. that do it. People have listed, for example, Amazon, Uber, maybe the old Uber, and Facebook as examples. No, I acknowledge that. But I'm saying for China, this is the standard approach. For U.S., you have a couple of outliers that take the heavy approach. Most companies still prefer the light approach. So the heavy approach is basically one which, because China used to be full of copycats, so every entrepreneur, the only way they can deliver an amazing company is build a company that is uncopyable. So that has led to a number of very unique and different models.
But, I'm sorry, I hate to divert the conversation. Okay. I do want to get back to the larger point, but... Okay. Where has China, it seems like China has not really broken so significantly outside of China, has it not? I mean, where is the sort of global dominance? What is the Chinese company that the U.S. is obsessed with, or Europeans?
Yeah, U.S. and Europe probably will not be obsessed with any Chinese software for some time to come. Here's a couple of reasons. First, China has never had the incentive to go outside China. The opportunity cost of hiring 100 more engineers for any Chinese company to go after U.S. market or European market or South American market is just not worth it compared to what they can get in China. Because just the China market alone you know, this is a larger market than U.S., EU, and India added up together in mm-hmm. terms of population. And also it's different enough that for people to go abroad, there wasn't just a draw, right? In Israel, the startups go abroad because the internal market is too small. That's the number one reason. So the companies we fund, we generally say don't go abroad because the domestic market is so large. Now, having said that, another reason is that China is not one type of user. There are actually multiple types of users. There are users that are quite similar to the American users and European users. Myself, the companies we fund, college professors and CEOs and so on. These people, the companies built products for these people, would have a hard time finding acceptance in equivalence markets because U.S. has already kind of won in the developed markets. In U.S., Europe, Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, it's already totally U.S. And the Chinese companies that build products similar to these companies, say in search or social or commerce, there's just no chance. It's already done. However, China actually has two other important demographics. One is third, fourth tier cities. These are smaller cities, generally younger people, and looking to for entertainment and even for just spending, burning time, not necessarily going after productivity. This group of user is actually quite similar to Southeast Asian users and perhaps Indian users. And then the third group is actually even further back in villages, just getting on the internet with very minimal financial resources, but are eager to use it for things that are used in villages and for extreme deep discount types of things because of their lower income. So that group is actually quite similar to African users, maybe ahead of Africa by 5 years, but similar in the way they're dispersed, their income and so on. So I would actually argue the companies developing products for the second group of Chinese users are already starting to penetrate Southeast Asia and India. It's just that they're just small, so you don't see it here in the U.S.
So your sense is that China isn't competing successfully with American companies in any of the developed markets of the world, but in the future, they might have a considerable edge in the developing markets of the world.
Yes.
One thing we've not talked a lot about is the role of the Chinese government in all of this. Mm-hmm. So in China, the Chinese companies do have free rein over an enormous market, but a lot of their competitors have been kept out by the government. One, if the Chinese entrepreneurs and employees really are this much better, why does the government need to protect the nation from competition? And two, is that not sort of playing the game with training wheels to a certain extent? Like, how could people who've enjoyed that sort of a monopoly on a market really compete with people who fight in every single...
I mean,
in the developing world, the U.S. is used to not having protection from the government. How does that factor in?
Oh, I think this is where there's rather significant confusion mm-hmm. about the so-called protectionism in China. So obviously, when you look at the trade war, there are many aspects of accusations of protectionism, and I won't defend China in the various cases of joint ventures and IP and protectionism. There are obviously issues that have to be dealt with. Now, in the case of internet companies, it's more corporate principles rather than protectionism that's kept companies out. I think China has fairly high expectations on things related to, you know, government access to data and censorship that many American companies can't accept. So at least take Google as an example. So it's not that the Chinese government won't let them in, it's the laws and regulations are viewed as unacceptable to Google for entering.
Well,
so it's a little trickier issue.
Google seems to be bending here?
It's not clear they will, but that's kind of part of the issue. And I think the Chinese government's primary intent is really that it's about that the laws are not compromisable. It's not to help the local competition beat the competitors. That's actually not the intent with respect to internet. If you look at automotive, China let the automotives in, but kind of asked them to share their technology with local companies. And then that caused the local companies to get better over time, which is what's causing dispute today. But in the internet space earlier, I think China certainly felt U.S. companies could come and teach a lot and in a similar model. But many U.S. companies either didn't put enough effort or didn't do it. But anyway, we're kind of at a different stage right now, such that regardless of protectionism, the Chinese companies are actually very strong. I would argue that if you and I were to each use our phones, yours in the US apps, I'm in the China apps, and then somebody from Mars gives us orders on what we could do, I could probably solve it faster than you. Not because I'm better, but because the apps actually are more extensive, at least for entertainment, social, commerce kinds of things, mm-hmm. not necessarily for productivity.
I think that that's probably true. We have someone in Asia right now, and he's spoken to me a bit about the way Asian markets have actually just embraced technology in a way that Western markets have not.
Yeah.
There are certain things that we didn't have to build. So our infrastructure, it was built decades ago.
That's the issue.
A lot of these Asian markets are developing, and so they can use the best technology available to do that. And so things like
late mover advantage.
Yeah.
So the late mover advantage, probably the clearest example, is mobile payment. U.S. has had the world's best payment infrastructure, namely credit cards, since the 80s and 90s, and people are used to it. It's really hard to give up, plus all the branding that Visa, MasterCard do. People are brainwashed thinking this has got to be the way you do all transactions. And also, I think the U.S. style of competition makes someone like a PayPal or Apple Pay still want to be built on top of credit cards rather than go fight them. The Chinese spirit of winner take all would have fought them, but the U.S. is more friendly. So in China, the credit card penetration has always been a single digits, very low. So the mobile payment only has to beat cash, which is a lot easier to beat. And then when it came out with two software companies, Tencent and Alibaba, the adoption went very quickly. They subsidized it with billions of dollars, giving money away to get people to hook their mobile payment to their bank account. And basically today, about 600, 700 million people have it, and they can pay each other micropayment as low as 15 cents a payment, and almost no commission, fully connected to the bank, and anyone can pay anyone. So anybody can set up shop. You don't need to get Square. Farmers market, beggars, everybody's using Scan. So suddenly cash and credit cards were just gone.
This is something that I think a lot of people in America don't know, and like even when they hear it, don't believe. It's unfathomable to them to think of China as a more technological civilization than the US. What are some other dimensions that you think, because of the late mover advantage, the Chinese people are just totally beyond us?
So the mobile is already here and today. The next few I'll do will be more projection into the future. One example is autonomous stores and retail. See, U.S. again had the world's best infrastructure for shopping, namely the shopping malls, super malls, but they became overbuilt given the rise of e-commerce. China actually never built that, because while China was still beginning to build malls, e-commerce had taken over both countries. And the Chinese real estate developers realized, let's not build those malls because people are buying everything from online. So the malls were never built. But we're kind of at a stage now where there are a lot of things that could be done in retail spaces if only they weren't so giant. It's hard for an American mall to justify its money based on the so few shoppers and shops, and they're carrying all the raw merchandises. So Amazon Go was the first to show, here's an autonomous store. And they're actually getting implemented everywhere in China. Not to the full Amazon Go level, but they would do things like use AI to predict sales forecast, inventory management, what products to order, what shelves to place them on as a data science part. And then moving on to automatic checkout, where it's not scanning one thing at a time with the UPC code, but rather just take the whole tray and getting it all to be paid using just a scale and a basically fisheye camera and computer vision to do the auto checkout. There are now vending machines that only cost a few thousand dollars that are giant refrigerators that you use your phone to unlock, and you can take whatever out you want from it. And these are getting installed everywhere. So this, now imagine the vending machine can sell anything, including coconuts and apple. It's not just limited to soft drinks. So retail is getting reinvented, and online and offline are getting integrated. Companies are coming out, are competing very heavily now on retail. I would predict in 2 to 3 years when you go to China, the retail will kind of have the convenience store of the future that's mostly autonomous, much lower cost, much higher profit, carrying what people want to carry. Another example is fast food. We see examples here in the U.S., some hamburger flipping robot. But in China, you know, we've invested in a company called F5 Future Store. The entire store is robotic, and it makes Chinese food, and the robotic arm brings it out to you. There are no humans. You scan your face or code, and the food is about half or a third of the price at McDonald's. So why would a Chinese person eat Western fast food when the local food is one half, one third the price? So I think this is a big area. Another big area is education. In Chinese education, because of the large student-to-teacher ratio and the rote learning style, which is not great. Nevertheless, when you have rote learning, you have a lot of homework and drills and pronunciation correction, math drills and homework and tests and quizzes. So that's now all being automated. So it's AI that grades all the homeworks and exams, including chemical equations, math proofs, and essays. So it's applying that very same AI that's shared across the world, but now the schools are more advanced and the teachers no longer has to deal with these repetitive things.
That's something that's emerging? It's an emerging education style, or is it penetrating today?
It's penetrating today.
And is that from the top down? Is this like sort of the government has decided that all schools are doing this, or is it in sort of certain areas, or...
I think the government played a supportive role, but not a primary role. It's really two companies, one we funded and then their competitor, that initially built these OCR machines for scanning papers. And then as AI came about, they added capabilities. And then they figured out new models. They're now giving away these scanners and recognition and then selling after-school teacher help to the parents. Because they know
Who's failing.
Well, they know who's failing. Yeah. So they target the parents, and that becomes the new business model. Plus, the quality of teachers is not even. So some of the best teachers are now able to go through a interactive MOOC that has one teacher teaching 1,000 kids, but the kids have a clicker to interface with the teacher. Kind of like sometimes we do in a conference, the teacher can ask a question and see how people are doing, make sure they're following, but doesn't allow for one-on-one interactivity. But then you've got the best teacher in the country teaching 1,000 at a time, and then again allowing the local teachers to be more mentors, one-on-one, and things like that. So that could propel the education forward as well, because the competency of the Chinese students in English pronunciation is dramatically improving, and also math competency. They're spending less time to learn multiplication and division. Therefore, they have more time to learn the creative skills. So education is one where U.S. is well ahead of China, I think, but AI is helping China to catch up as well.
Really fascinating. Could you just paint a picture for me of the future? What do you see? What does the future of AI look like?
The good thing is that AI, we can see in the next 10 to 15 years being applied to everything internet, because that's where there's the most data in a single domain with a clear measure to make money or save money. And then we'll see AI penetrating in all the businesses. All the businesses have data, can use it immediately. The ones that don't, better start collecting data. This is still data science level, but it's really to any company with significant data. And then we see computer speech and vision basically put everywhere. This may have some privacy issues, but in China, the sensors and the cameras are being put up in a lot of places. When I talked about retail and schools and hospitals, they're all experimenting with putting cameras and sensors, not for the purpose of invading people's privacy, but obviously you would be captured and there would be concern. But once you capture at that level of detail, you can actually auto-label and become very, very accurate in predicting not only human face, human gait and gesture, but also their intention and emotion. This is at the same time dangerous, but also very valuable. I'm also very optimistic about robotics. We have a lot of investments in robotics. We think robotics will be doing the routine work so we don't have to. From factories, manufacturing, inspection, to agriculture in terms of fertilizing, targeted watering, picking the fruits, and also, of course, to eventually to the home, commercial, dishwashing, home cleaning, and so on. And of course, autonomous vehicles. There's debates on how long that would take, but there's no doubt one day we would not be driving anymore.
This is Anatomy of Next.